Hello, and welcome to the Libertarian Podcast. I'm your host, Troy Senek, joined, as always, by the Libertarian himself, Professor Richard Epstein, Senior Fellow at the Hoover Institution, as well as Professor of Law at NYU and Senior Lecturer at the University of Chicago. Today, is there a crisis of liberalism? And Richard, a bit of a more philosophical conversation today. You recently wrote a piece for Defining Ideas in reaction to a Wall Street Journal weekend interview with Patrick Deneen, the Notre Dame political scientist who's received a lot of attention for his recent book, which is called Why Liberalism Failed. And we should note that that's liberalism not in the sense of the left wing of the Democratic Party, but in the sense of the liberal form of government that we have in the United States. And Deneen's case is somewhat abstract, but let me start by boiling it down to one of the points on which he is more concrete, which is that liberal systems, in his argument, have a tendency to make people think of themselves as atomistic individuals disconnected from the broader society, seeking only to maximize their individual utility, and as such leads to a kind of fraying of social ties, and then voila, in steps the state. What's your reaction to that diagnosis?
I mean, I spent a lot of time with a lot of people, and virtually everybody I've ever met at any time understands that their life has multiple components. One of them is family, in which you certainly do not engage in atomistic behavior. Another tends out to be marketplaces, where cooperation amongst teams is often extremely important. And then three, there are all of these sort of intermediate organizations, churches, charitable activities, and so forth. And virtually everybody I know follows the following view. I can't be a part of every organization. I can't be a part of every charity, every church, and so forth. But I regard myself as being sort of less than ideal if the only thing that I do is maximize my profit. And so what happens is the libertarian version or the classical liberal version, I'm saying, says, yes, you do have the right to decide to offer to withhold your services to whomever you see fit. But it hardly follows from that that what you're going to do when you have that situation is to be relentlessly egotistical with everybody else in the world and to be completely non-cooperative. Every single serious classical liberal starts to assume that you have to have at least two kinds of social systems. One is, in fact, a very powerful legal system where, in fact, if people trespass certain kinds of norms, they are going to be met with certain kinds of collective sanctions. There is no soft sanctions that are going to work against aggression, and people should never think that that's going to be the case. And if you have breach of contract in a lot of commercial situations, you can't rely on goodwill if you've got yourself $1 billion that are at stake in some kind of situation. But from the beginning, people understand that there are all sorts of informal arrangements that we have of social one kind or another for which a breach of a particular duty doesn't give rise to a cause of action. But what it does is it gives rise to a bit of social sanctions, disapproval, and so forth. Somebody constantly fails to show up for dinner and doesn't be particularly repentant. He's going to lose or she's going to lose all sorts of friends. The way in which these things tend to work is, well, I'm supposed to meet you at the restaurant for dinner on Tuesday. And it turns out I just plumb forgot. Now, what do? I could say to you, you know what? We've looked at this arrangement. There's no intention to create legal arrangements, so stuff off. It doesn't make a difference. Well, you can do that once, and that's the end of a friendship. And that word friendship is something that libertarians, or at least some of them, understand. Or what you can do, you say, oh my God, I'm so sorry. Let me take you out to dinner next week. Instead of dividing the bill, you make up for it by doing it. This kind of stuff happens all the time and in every particular way. So what I do is when I read this essay, I said to myself, is Mr. Deneen sufficiently socialized? Because if he were, he would never, ever, in any circumstances, say that. And if you go back to this historically, the relationship is exactly the inverse of what he said. During the late 19th century in England, the home of laissez-faire, you had all sorts of eleemosynary institutions going up, many of them with an explicitly redistributive nature. These were called imperfect obligations. You were not under any legal compulsion whatsoever to help any given person, but socially and as a matter of conscience, you darn well, if you had the money and the resources to do so, were expected to try to help somebody. And this was not just an idle promise. I keep on saying, well, who is Leland Stanford Jr.? Well, he was the son of Leland Stanford. The boy dies and the father decides to give his farm over to get a great university. Who is Sloan Kettering, you ask people? Well, Alfred Sloan and Charlie Kettering were the guys who brought General Motors to prominence in the 20s. What do they do with their money? They start a world-class cancer institute. Johns Hopkins, another mandate. You just go through all of these people and you realize that virtually every one of them understands that the marginal gain you get from consuming your second $1 billion is rather low, and you become essentially some kind of a social benefactor. And none of this seems to actually penetrate anything that's involved. Even when you're dealing with poorer people, friendly societies, organizing a clam bake, this happens. You know, you get somebody who's ill and they come home from the hospital and the spouse is stretched. Four friends bring dinner over. So that you can serve it. They don't send a bill afterwards for giving the dinner. It's a sort of loose reciprocity amongst decent people. And so if you start to associate liberalism, or rather libertarianism or classical liberal or even modern liberalism with atomism, what you're doing is you're mistaking the legal superstructure on the one hand with the full set of social arrangements. The Tocqueville was right when he says the success or failure of any particular nation depends upon its ability to foster intermediate institutions. And what happens is if you start having the state doing everything, for example, and taking care of the poor, well, it's going to make it very, very difficult for those intermediate institutions to survive, which is one of the reasons why the modern social democratic state may in some sense be less cohesive than the classical liberal state, which tended not to think, except in very minimal sense, as redistribution of wealth, equality of wealth, as being the central purpose of the state.
Richard, the Dineen book is part of a broader civil war that's going on amongst intellectuals on the right at the moment. And I apologize to our listeners in advance for any imprecision, because there are a lot of different players here, and I don't want to suggest that their positions are interchangeable. But the criticism that you're seeing from certain segments of the right is that the conservative establishment, intellectual establishment anyway, has gone overboard in the way that it thinks about markets, that it has elevated economic efficiency above all other considerations. So Henry Olson, for instance, definitely a conservative in good standing, wrote a piece recently in the Washington Post. Let me just read you this brief quotation. Other factors, that is, beyond economic efficiency, such as social order and family formation, are also worthy goals to which pure economic efficiency or growth must bend at times. My libertarian-oriented friends will not want to hear this, but we live in the garden that Franklin D. Roosevelt made. The conservative task is to prune that garden so that the tree of liberty can coexist within its plan and perhaps take up an ever larger part. That task is politically hindered by the unyielding intransigence of those whose goal is to rip up the garden itself. For that reason, this debate is fundamental to the future of conservatism and perhaps of the United States itself. How do you react to that?
Well, it doesn't describe me. I've long taken the position about the importance of culture and norms, of voluntary institutions and so forth. I just articulated it 2 minutes ago. And the thought that anything that Franklin Roosevelt did was going to create the sort of garden that he's talking about was wrong. What Roosevelt did, in effect, was to make everything a matter of legal sanctions one way or another. So if you were to look at the labor relationships, the formal contract was always one of will, at will. You can hire or fire for good reason, bad reason, no reason at all. You could quit for exactly the same reason. And the way in which these arrangements started to work pretty well is that people realized that if there were gains from long-term relationships, you start making accommodations along the way so that both sides can be better off without pulling the ultimate thing. You introduce the National Labor Relations Act. What does it do? It basically says that the worker cannot have relationships with the management team anymore because there's a union which is interposed, and in fact, it is an unfair labor practice for a management person to speak to a worker without a union representative there. And so what you do is you create exactly the wrong kind of legal formalism when you start to create these separations. If you're trying to talk about other kinds of adjustments, you really think you're going to get any benefits out of this by minimum wage laws, overtime laws, and all the rest of that stuff. No, what they do is they tend to take things out of the social domain and put them into the legal domain. They tend to do it by creating all sorts of powerful institutions that can intervene, and then they have a government on top of all of this stuff. So Roosevelt essentially destroyed all sorts of intermediate institutions. He did not create them. And what you have to do is, if you want to get rid of the National Labor Relations Act, as I passionately do, it's not because what you want to do is to have employers say to every employee, off with your head. It's because you believe that informal relationships that make these adjustments in the long term are far better than situations where the law comes in at the very early situation. So as I said earlier, every classical version of the liberal doctrine always assumed that there was some transactions where there was no intention to create legal relations. 1 year ago, the first class I used to teach, case I used to teach in contracts law, was a case called Balfour and Balfour. And this was a situation in which a husband and wife separated in amity, and he promised to pay her a rather fancy sum of £200 a year, this is about 1910 or 1920, while he was away in Ceylon. And then it turned out the whole marriage broke up, and the question was whether this was a legal relationship or a social relationship. And Lord Atkin said, it's a social relationship, not enforceable. He was nuts. When you have that long kind of separation taking place between people with large financial sums, to analyze that as if it's an invitation for dinner which you forget to meet is just a failure of understanding the correct relationships. And sure enough, the English some years later modified their marital code so as to say when you have these kinds of arrangements, they're going to be enforceable. So I'm not saying there aren't any problems about enforcing what the line is, but I regard this sort of attack on conservatism, at least the sort that I'm worried about, as being crazy. And there are also many strands of conservatism of the Burkean, Hayekian variety who take exactly the same position. Hayek himself used to rail all against people who started to think that only utilitarian constructivism was the thing that worked. So I regard this as a defeat of a caricature rather than a serious engagement. So what I would ask Henry, what I would ask Deneen, what I'd ask the whole lot, is I'm going to tell you a series of legislation or regulations that I want to get away with. And you tell me which of them we should keep on the grounds that it will promote the kind of caring, familiar, cross-sensitive arrangements that otherwise exist. And I think if you go through the major innovations of the Roosevelt period, whether you're talking about the Federal Communication System, the Federal Trade Act, the National Labor Relations Board, or the Aeronautics Act and so forth, the Agricultural Adjustment Act, what you discover is that virtually all of these at their root have something which nobody in their right mind should want to defend, mainly the effort to cartelize some kind of industry and to displace competitive purchases. So the enemy is the cartel. And if in a competitive market where people are free to choose the grounds on which they associate with other individuals, there's nothing which says that you have to have every relationship as though it's one for financial gain. And most people would absolutely recoil if that was a way in which you thought that they or described them or accused them of living their own lives. So I think that this is absolutely the world's most giant red herring. It is a complete distortion of the way in which a sensible society starts to work. And there's nothing about Franklin Roosevelt, which created a Garden of Eden. He did create a lot of long-term debts in Social Security and so forth. We have to negotiate. And even that's a classic illustration of danger. Why? Because Alfred Sloan, whom I had mentioned, around 1932, he said, you know, our workers are living longer now. We have to start to develop a systematic pension program, which would have worked a lot better than Social Security. And yet it was promptly dismantled when Social Security was put into place. And that system turns out to be highly political, precisely because there's no cooperation in there. It's every generation out for itself. And the amount of wealth transfers that take place by putting in contributions from one group, which are taken out from another group, which does not create harmony or cooperation, is, as everybody knows, downright legendary.
In your piece on Deneen, you talk about the frequent and, in your judgment, mistaken conflation of libertarianism with classical liberalism. We may have contributed to that confusion here on a podcast called The Libertarian, when you yourself much prefer the classical liberal label. So explain for us how you parse the difference between the two and why it matters.
Well, I mean, libertarian has this unenviable position. It is both the genus at the top, and then it's each of the two species underneath it. And so libertarianism, in some large sense of the world, could be simply associated with either small government and strong property and strong contract rights, strong voluntary associations, right? It could be that, or it could be associated with anarchism. in which it turns out the only thing you're not supposed to do is engage in force or fraud. So it turns out you cannot be made to pay taxes in order to keep things going. The difference between the two of these systems is absolutely profound. The classical liberal understands that there are breakdowns in voluntary transactions caused by high transactions costs when multiple actors have to be gotten on the same page. It does nobody any good to have 98% of the population agree we're never going to use force against the neighbor if that other 2% is armed with machine guns and takes everybody over. And so what you have to do is you need to use coercion in a way that allows you to collect resources from society in order to protect good individuals in society from the bad individuals. And then it also turns out you need eminent domain if they're critical assets that you need, which you cannot get through voluntary purchase. Nobody really thinks it's serious that you could build a railroad from San Francisco to the Midwest, and then it turns out you have to make a voluntary transaction with anybody, and there's some guy who owns 10 feet of land, and he says, you know, I don't care what they do on the east of me. I'm not care what they're doing on the west of me. You want to complete this railroad, pay me $1 billion. And so we use an eminent domain system so as to give him the best alternative use of the property, but to take away the holdout problem. The libertarian, in more technical terms, understands aggression, doesn't understand holdouts. So he doesn't understand the role for taxation, doesn't understand the role for eminent domain, doesn't understand the role for common pool regulation, doesn't understand the role for antitrust. It's all no force, no fraud. That's the great weakness of somebody like Murray Rothbard. And so there's a huge difference between them on that score. The second one is the libertarian doesn't worry about any soft obligations. Joseph Story wrote about this a long time ago, a great genius, called Imperfect Obligations. And that's the theory which I mentioned to you earlier. You're a member of society. You can pick whom it is in need that you want to help, but you're not a decent or a full human being if you do it for nobody. And people really responded to that. Now, the other side is progressivism. And what progressivism does is it tends to get rid of these soft virtues. It tends to downplay eminent domain. Because regulatory takings are generally not compensable. So you want to wipe out somebody's air rights. You want to basically impose huge restrictions through zoning. Generally, the no compensation solution is there. And one of the things that happens is you've got these three different positions. And if somebody says all of them are liberalism, there's some affection between the libertarian and the classical liberal. The progressives on the other side of the divide. And Dineen just simply doesn't understand these things. So when he attacks the framers, it's as though the 1937 constitutional revolution did not take place. When I read this book, I boggled because all of the distinctions that are necessary to understand how it is that variations in governmental type work within the Western civilization are lost. And as he starts to become cynical about all of them, what happens is, as was mentioned in the back of this thing, all of a sudden, you know, why should I be critical of the Chinese that they cart people off to the mainland, away out of Hong Kong, force them into arbitrary trials and so forth? No progressive is in favor of that kind of incarceration. And Dineen essentially is somebody who is so down on democratic institutions that he's not going to be a friend. And we really need friends of somebody in the United States to stand up to the Chinese and at least say, we regard what you do in Hong Kong as authoritarian, delusive, disgusting, and immoral. We have no respect for anything that happens. Mr. Xi, when you call yourself a president for life, you become a dictator. And when your legislature becomes a rubber stamp of everything you want, it's exactly what happened when the German Bund gave up, or the German parliament gave up all its powers to Hitler in, I guess it was in May or so of 1933. I mean, it gets very, very scary. And one has to keep a perspective. And you don't want to so denigrate what's going on in the United States that you make respectable, truly horrific institutions that take place too many places around the world. Russia and China are the leading ones. Frank Fukuyama is a dear man, good friend. But boy, did history not end in 2000. It turns out that the totalitarian instincts are on the rise. And people like Dineen make it that much harder for people to combat them.
All right. You've been listening to the Libertarian Podcast with Richard Epstein. Remember, you can follow Richard on Twitter at Richard A. Epstein. You can read his weekly column. It's called The Libertarian, by visiting Defining Ideas at Hoover.org. And you can help us out by rating the show on iTunes. For Richard Epstein, I'm Troy Senek. Thanks for listening.
This podcast has been a production of the Hoover Institution. For more information about our work, please visit hoover.org.